Thank you, and thank you for hanging around. And I'm hoping that you're all fairly caffeinated and ready for an interactive session. It being the end of the day, and that being the point where we've got to keep the motion going. So Michael Nielsen opened this morning with what I saw as a challenge. Many of us, I think most of us, believe that online technologies offer the opportunities to do science better, faster, more effectively, more inclusively, and to reach whatever the goals of science are more effectively. But that there's a problem of collective action to do this, that the incentives are not in place necessarily to get those potential goals realised. And so the question we're posing here with these panels is to surface the problems firstly, but to get beyond those problems and start to try and look at solutions. Tomorrow morning, there's a series of sessions that are focused on really trying to solve problems for a specific disease with a very specific target. And again, the challenges there lie in, it's great to do that on a Saturday morning and a Saturday afternoon, but what's going to happen when people go back to the bench, back to their labs, back to their offices? How is that going to continue, and how do we make that part of the everyday practice of research? So we've got a really diverse panel of people here bringing a bunch of different perspectives, and I've asked them all to speak from their personal perspective, so they're not here representing their various institutions. I am not here representing STFC, but bringing that perspective and experience of a lot of things. And I'll introduce them as we go through the process. So to start with the researcher perspective, Jeremy Frey is a professor in chemistry at the University of Southampton. Has been involved in a lot of the technical development of data and laboratory management tools in the UK over the past 10 years, I guess. Yeah. So I guess, Jeremy, could you start by talking a little bit about that work and how the challenges involved in getting credit for that work within the institution?
Certainly. So yeah, my area, I'm a physical chemist, and typically in the system, in the university in the UK, was judged as a physical chemist. To do my job, I actually worked in quite an interdisciplinary way already with the physics community, and that was relatively simple because my colleagues recognised physics as a reasonable discipline. It's another physical science, and it's okay, and they actually understand the journals that we might even put something in, and indeed there were journals to put stuff in. But right from the beginning, when confronted with the problem of what did we do with that data, and can I give it to somebody, or can I even find it from my former research student who's now left, all the problems that you'll be well aware of, they got increasingly difficult when we could actually collect the data and save it. We got involved in the UK eScience programme, which gave us an opportunity to develop things. So that was very nice. Somebody provided some funding, which otherwise would have been totally unpredictable that you would get funding in this area. And you can justify this to some of your colleagues by, well, it will make their life easier. And indeed, it has made our life easier, which is much more important. It's made my life a lot easier. I now see where all the problems are with my students' data. That may be why there are fewer publications, right? You know, it has an interesting perspective here. But equally, well, I can make the data available and we can look at it again and so on. But you do get to the point that you spending a lot of time doing this sort of development work, trying to make sure that you're using the most modern tools, that we're really engaging the right people to write the right sort of software. But it's not just purely, oh, can I commission somebody to write it? Because we don't actually know what needs to be done. We have a vague idea because we've always been writing things in books. We need to do something like that, but better. And those were the sort of questions that prompted us. So you are doing research, at least you can convince yourself, and I could, in the end, convince some of my colleagues in other departments that I was doing research. Convincing my colleagues in chemistry was a bit more difficult. Convincing the promotion panels that this was a legitimate output when they would put a question, what is the output? Where is it? So, well, it's something that's really going to save lots of people's time. Show me that. Well, yeah, but that takes a long time. You know, show me that this paper was a really good paper. Well, you'll be aware of those issues. Interestingly, you go to your appraisals, which we now have yearly, and a few years ago you get, well, I think you better stop doing this project because that was really good, it got some publicity, gone on the BBC website, but can't see that that's going to be terribly useful going forward for chemistry. A few years down the line, you go to a discussion, a ref discussion, as it inevitably is, and they say, impact. Oh, now that was interesting, that project you did that got on the BBC website and potentially engaged lots of other people. And you say, yeah, well, we stopped it because what we needed is another 6 months' money to engage another colleague to rewrite their software in such a way that it can be used publicly and all the rest of it. You know the story. It changes. Well, everything does change, and that's fine. And one of the great advantages of what we're talking about here about the software-based approach to doing things is that you can change much more rapidly. Because whilst we have confronted all these problems in getting personal recognition, will the outputs of this work that we're now trying to do properly, as opposed to all my colleagues who were doing it secretly by getting their students to write the database when they didn't really know how to write a database, and it lasted for 2.5 years, and then the new students came along and did, well, the same thing all over again. So there's a huge cost that was going on there, and nothing ever came out further because it wasn't done in a usable enough manner. So we're trying to solve that sort of thing. These things come round again. But actually, of course, there's nothing new here at all. If you talk to the people who produced all the electronics that we used before, and still do, what recognition did they get? Well, at some level, it becomes they were employed by the institution to provide the electronic support, and they were happy enough that their instruments got used. Actually, now it's even difficult to pay for those people. If you get to a level where it's purely a make what I tell you to make, well, okay, that can be done, but it's not a great job. When you don't even know how to tell them what to make it, then you've got the difficulty. You're trying to do the research. They don't get credit. You don't get credit. But is it really any different from the glassblower who made the superb piece of equipment and you didn't put their name on the traditional chemistry publication? They didn't have to go to an appraisal process that said, what outputs did you produce? We've got ourselves caught up in a circle where we really ought to have known that this problem was there. Unfortunately, the various things we bring in to check whether we are doing a good job or not haven't actually made the problem any better. They've made the problem worse, and the cycling time in the sort of software approach is so much faster, and the thing can become out of date so much quicker that it's more difficult to use traditional norms to say whether or not you've achieved anything. And that's where we are at the moment. We're trying hard. We do get money in to do these things. We are trying to make sure that our non-traditional outputs get a lot of publicity and get used by people. And in the end, that's probably the biggest thing that allows us to counter the traditional approaches, show me what you've done in terms of a high-ranking publication. So maybe you turn up in the Nature News column rather than the Nature Journal publication column, but that's still something in Nature. We have to fight on all these things, and we're trying our best.
Okay, so there's the researcher perspective and the problems that are faced by someone who exists within an institution and needs to fit within the institutional appraisal funding processes and management arrangements. So Giles Carden is head of strategy at Warwick University. He's also an expert on the research excellence framework, which will no doubt come up at some point. So to Giles then, what can an institution do if you've got these innovative people doing new types of research, creating new types of output? What is the institution doing to support that, and what are the problems that you face in supporting it?
Well, if I start with some of the problems to start off with, I mean, if you take things like REE and REF, obviously universities and senior university managers have to worry about this compliance environment that we sit in. And obviously attached to this is also a considerable amount of funding. And if I take my institution, it's about £35 million per annum. Universities aren't businesses, and they run relatively shallow surpluses, but they can't afford to run deficits, otherwise they lose their ability to invest. So we've got to chase strategies to do well in some of these exercises, because it affects both funding and the reputation of the institution. That's one thing that vice chancellors, finance directors, registrars and chief operating officers worry an awful lot about. To some extent, the same applies to other funding bodies as well. If you take the REF is a very significant indicator of a UK university's reputation. And dare I say, it feeds into the dreaded, I'll use the expletive, league tables. Can't avoid mentioning them, as it's something that takes up a lot of my time. Love them or loathe them, they're here to stay. They do have an impact to some degree. Woe betide any university that publicises their league table position on their homepage, in my view, but because it's a hostage to fortune. But they do have an impact, for example, on things like overseas student recruitment, which is a very important revenue stream. However, all of these compliance mechanisms create perverse behaviours to some extent. And if you take REE, one of the things that REE has done to a greater rather than a lesser extent is favour traditional forms of output. Now, some panels have behaved differently towards alternative forms of output, but in many discipline areas it does favour traditional forms of outputs. Thus, academic colleagues are encouraged and indeed rewarded by many institutions for getting, for example, you know, excellent monographs published with very good publishers, or journals published in high impact articles published in very high impact journals. So those are the problems we face. But I think universities can invest in mechanisms and systems to help support this sort of new vogue of research landscape. I mean, at Warwick, for example, we've invested in a thing called the Knowledge Centre, which is, you know, obviously web-based, where there's a whole load of content on research learning, live web chats with researchers and things, proved to be very popular. We've got a YouTube Edu presence, iTunes U presence, for example, as well. I think also senior managers in universities can lobby these bodies, funding bodies principally, that require this compliance. And ultimately, you know, it's the academic community, the academic masses that can invoke change. I've sat as a secretary on REE panels in the past, and I've watched how the academic members of, you know, members of the academic community, if you take the last REE, there were 900 panelists across all the panelists. That's an awful lot of panelists, and they do have influence on the funding bodies. You know, they set the criteria, they have to work within the framework, but they can fight to change the framework. But there needs to be a critical mass to invoke this kind of change. So institutions can also, you know, support institutional repositories and alternative ways of sort of disseminating research and research output. The other thing as well, actually, is the better we are at diversifying our funding streams, the more independent and strong-willed we can be as higher education institutions.
So we've had the researcher blame the institution, the institution blame the researchers, and then the institutions also, funding comes back at the centre of this, and of course we all know it's all the funder's fault. I work for a funder, incidentally, that's why I'm not recognising my affiliation. So Murray Williams is head of evaluation at the Biological and Biotechnological Sciences Research Council. She's also been involved in a lot of the cross research council efforts to look at research outputs and outcomes. So the question, I guess, passing it to Murray is what are funders doing? What can funders do? And what are the constraints you face in changing and trying to improve research practice?
Okay, at one level, I'll start off by saying quite often we do blame. That's okay. I've lived with blame for 20 years and I'll have to carry on that way. However, on a more positive note, constraints. Well, I think pretty much the real big constraint at the moment is absolutely clear. Some people were in the first session after lunch, were in the science question time. We rehearsed all the things around funding constraints then, and public funding, public cuts in the research budget. And yes, the research councils did relatively well in the spending review. We didn't do brilliantly. Nobody did brilliantly. The funding envelope is sustained in terms of grant funding, not in terms of capital. There are all sorts of constraints within that. Nevertheless, we're not in a position as public bodies to be too dissatisfied with that, because there are big comparators out there. If you think about the way public money has to be, the use of it has to be prioritised. I was at a talk recently where somebody made the very pertinent point about whenever we in the public sector are spending money, we need to bear in mind that there are recipients of public funding, the elderly, the infirm, who are having to make really stark choices between medical support or social support. And we do have to be mindful of that. We do have to justify why it's worth investing in research. And that is something that the research councils do try to do. The other things we are trying to do, and I think actually this is true whatever the funding landscape is like, I think it's a perfectly legitimate question, whatever the level of investment in research and whatever the demands on the budget are, to be able to explain, justify and defend public funding of research. And also at the more detailed level, it is a perfectly legitimate question to ask, what are we getting? And by we, I mean the funding bodies, the research councils, the parent departments, the public. What are we getting for the large sums of money that are being invested? Interestingly, at the end of the session, just after lunch, the science question time, we started to touch on this and there wasn't time to explore it any further. And I was interested to pick up from the discussion that there's a view that the research councils and the funders know a lot about why we fund things, but rather less about what we get for the money that goes in. And I would agree with that. Nevertheless, we do quite a lot. I've worked in so-called evaluation, and by evaluation, I'm using that fairly strictly in the assessment array of terms. I'm using it to mean evaluation of what we've got after the event, rather than evaluation through peer review at the outset, which I've always called appraisal. We are looking at, recently BBSRC, for example, has evaluated portfolio by portfolio our entire responsive mode funding over a 10-year period. And what have we been looking for to explain what's good about it and to find out what's less good about it? We've been looking at outputs, we've been looking at outcomes, and we've been looking at impacts insofar as we can, because we haven't got huge amounts of evidence of that. The other thing that's important to note is that going forward, all the research councils are going to be taking a bigger and bigger interest in this, because we are all under an obligation to demonstrate to BIS what is coming out from the research base, and to arm BIS with very good arguments for why it's important that the Treasury keeps funding public research. So we've all got an interest in developing research outcome systems. There are a couple that have been around for some time. A lot of you may know EVAL, which is the system that the MRC and more recently the SDFC are interested in, and I think some of the big medical charities are interested in EVAL as well. The Natural Environment Research Council has a system called Research Outputs Database for some years, and it started off as literally a paper exercise and has now become an online exercise. The other research councils are working with ESRC on a version of their outputs database, which is Society Today, in which we are looking to capture outputs, outcomes, and impacts from research. And we are looking quite widely. We are not limiting it to publications. We do want to know about publications, of course, because to a large extent, and for a lot of the research communities we work with, that is the main currency, and we can't not talk about publications. But we are looking at publications in quite a wide sense. We don't just mean refereed papers in leading journals. We need to look at books, we need to look at posters, we need to look at conference proceedings, all the sort of the written media. We are looking at those. We're asking for information about essentially, what has changed as a result of the money we've put in? This is the impact question. What difference has it made that you as a PI have spent 3 years, 4 years, 5 years spending £500,000 on the research you're doing? What's changed? And that's the sort of evidence we're looking for to put together to make our case for retaining the research budget. My final point, I think, would be to say, please help. I've listened a lot today about the sorts of things that are going on and the way in which online science can help get science out to the rest of the world, can capture things that are important, and can add the quality watermark as well, because that is important. There's a lot of debate, I know, about anybody can put anything online. How do you know it's a useful piece of information, a true piece of information, a valuable piece of information? So any quality controls you're putting in, We need to know about that, and you need to help us make our case. Thanks.
So if there's a theme that's emerging so far, I think it's the element that we've got very different perspectives, very different constraints, but everyone actually really wants to drive the research funding to be used in the most effective way, but also actually wants to make a difference. I think there's a common theme there. And then the other one is one of information. And I really emphasise Mari's point is that actually the research community has a habit of whining about requests for information and then complaining when the research funders don't deliver on creating more money out of thin air. So I'd emphasise that. But so far this discussion's been very much about what happens within the ivory tower. And a lot of what's been talked about today has been very much how to engage with the wider community. There's been talks about citizen science and crowdsourcing. But I wanted to take this one step further in this panel session because I think it's an important part of the research landscape for the future. So Nick Barnes is one of the founders of the Climate Code Foundation, and I'll actually leave it there and ask you to talk about where the Climate Code Foundation came from and what the motivations were and what your experience was that you brought to it.
Sure. Thanks, Cameron. The original background is in 2008. I'm a software professional. I'm not an academic by background. 20 years ago, I was a computer scientist, but I've spent more than a decade being a software consultant running a small firm based in Cambridge, a software consultancy of all sorts, but not academic software, but with an increasing personal interest in and passion for climate science, as I see it becoming more important to us collectively, globally. And in 2008, I saw an opportunity to use my professional skills to advance climate science, and I set up a project called Clear Climate Code, which is an open source project hosted at Google Code, in order to take an existing body, small body of climate science software, which had been widely misunderstood and one might say misrepresented out there on the internet. Someone was wrong on the internet. This is my motivation. I had to do something about that, right? I can go to bed. So David, who's sitting down here, and I, he's a colleague of mine at this consultancy firm. We got together to take this body of code and rewrite it with our sole goal being clarity, to implement exactly the same algorithm, but to re-implement it in clear Python, as it happens, all very documented in great detail. And we did that over the course of about a year and a half, very much in our spare time, unfunded. And the people who'd written the original code is a group at NASA called GIS, the Goddard Institute for Space Science. They welcomed our work, they provided us with intermediate data, and the project's been very successful. We exactly matched NASA's results, and in our new body of code, because it's compact and clear, anyone can download it, anyone who's interested in the subject can read it. The notion that there might be some mysterious hidden data manipulations in this algorithm went away. Mostly don't see people claiming that on the internet anymore. Fewer people are wrong about that on the internet now. and it allows us and other people to ask and answer new questions quite rapidly in this small area of climate science. So last year we then started to broaden that, firstly within the notion of Clear Climate Code, to extend that to other code bases in climate science. And then in August of last year, both of us felt that we weren't having as much impact in climate science and on the public perception of climate science as we would like. So we set up a non-profit company here in the UK called the Climate Code Foundation, which is who I am actually speaking on behalf of the Climate Code Foundation, unlike my other panel members, because it's David and myself, so that's easy for me to claim. And we are starting to have an impact more broadly throughout climate science. People are noticing us. I've been invited here, that's nice. I'm invited to speak at various conferences. Google had us as a Summer of Code mentoring organisation this year. We have publications forthcoming. There's one in IEEE software coming out in the autumn. We have at least David's drafting another one. We have ideas for other actual science. So I used to open talks by saying I'm not a scientist, but I think that's probably not quite true anymore. I'm becoming a published scientist. I'm engaging in peer review. Journals, I mean, even before we had anything in press, journals were sending me stuff to review. So that's kind of interesting. So I'm seeing acceptance from, growing acceptance from the scientific community. And there are still obstacles to us sort of achieving the outcomes that we want.
So, I mean, just to follow up on that, it's how much luck have you had with funding this work?
Cameron knows the answer to this question. So I said a couple of minutes ago, I set up a non-profit organisation called the Climate Code Foundation. It's actually a non-revenue organisation with an honourable, but a very honourable exception, that Peter Murray-Rust, who's also on our advisory committee, sitting here in the front row, he got us in to do some contract programming on a small prototype project earlier this year, and we charged a day rate for that, and that has basically paid for our travel and so forth over the last year. Neither David nor I have received a penny for our work. And I'm working, roughly speaking, I'm working 40 hours a week on Climate Code Foundation now.
So I think, and that was the point that I think is one that's very well made, is that we have people in the community, in the wider community, who have expertise, who want to contribute back, and who are foregoing salary to do that at the moment. And I guess the question I put back to the other panel members, sitting from within in the ivory tower and in the established systems, that seems like a challenge in terms of being able to most efficiently take the public money that we do have. What are the things we might be able to do to encourage people like Nick and others at a range of different levels to really engage more effectively? And what are the challenges that that poses?
Okay, from the Research Council's point of view, technically speaking, the Research Councils don't fund private sector organisations. What we do is work in partnership with some. We have, there's one model in BBSRC called the Research Technology Club. At the moment, though, to be part of the club, the industrial or private sector partner has to make a contribution of monies. It doesn't have to be very much, in fact, and then get a say in how the research monies that are put in by BBSRC and some of the other research councils as well are allocated. We would strongly encourage our community to be working in partnership with private sector. There is a problem about directly funding the private sector from Research Council budgets. I know that there's quite a lot of interest in how that can be not resolved, because the problem we have is that private sector covers a great range of things. It covers people like Nick's organisation, but it covers people like GlaxoSmithKline. Now, I genuinely don't think the Research Council should be putting money into research carried out by GlaxoSmithKline, because that's not our role. They fund their own. But we work with them. We work in partnership on the sorts of research that is mutually interesting. And that's going to sound bad to a lot of people in this room, I dare say, but actually GSK are very, very interested in basic biology, which is what we fund. How we break that and make it easier for small businesses and new businesses to directly get money from us is quite interesting. I mean, there is funding, things like follow-on fund for academics to take ideas to a step further along the commercialization exploitation route, but there is a point at which we are no longer able to fund it if it becomes a private enterprise endeavor.
So from my ivory tower, which increasingly looks less and less ivory even from the inside, we are a business, as been pointed out, and there are major constraints and rapidly changing things at the moment with the whole fee issue. So, you know, inside the ivory tower looks very different perhaps from what it's perceived as from the outside. You have government ministers who think we obviously don't do anything in the summer still, because all we do is teach, apparently. Yet, at the other point, they want all these research outputs as well. It's very strange. But I would like to, from that perspective, you know, say two things about my institution is extremely good at trying to bridge these gaps. So I am in receipt of have follow-on funds, other and so on. And then, actually, my brother, who's sort of in this game a bit, points out, is that second mile is the problem. How do you get to bid to the venture capitalists? You've got a step up of at least an order of magnitude in funds there. And there are ways and means of doing that. Institutions create funds, and it's in their interest to do so, and Southampton has actually been very successful. But I would actually like to be, in general, supportive of the research councils. Up until the last few years, they have actually done very well on funding in amounts of money, and that has shown by the fact that build your zone and move out of your zone, that has been very much not an issue with the research councils. They've tried to be inclusive and be supportive. I think that may change a little bit in the next year or so as they're siloing again, just like everybody else. Just to give you an illustration that this is not new and not specifically to do with online, because I think about 10 years ago, I got the usual rejection of what I thought was an excellent grant application. And subsequently, it became clear from the EPSRC officials that I met that they also were a bit puzzled about this. And the interesting line that was internally in the committee report was, this was too adventurous a proposal. Not too so adventurous that it's not supported, not enough supporting information, that would be fine, but just too adventurous, too risky. Now, that then did actually add to all the accumulating evidence that I believe then changed the questions that the referees were asked, because the academic community is very conservative. That's why some parts involve in double-blind peer review to deal with some of these things. We are conservative, but if you're asked a question, you give the answer. And if you change the question, then you can get a different answer. And research councils have been extremely good about trying to understand how to deal with that. I would say that the institutions have been not so good at responding. Nonetheless, the fact that I got promoted in the end shows that they can also move with these things and understand changes. But it is very important for all of these organizations to understand where they want to go and then work out where the problem is. And if they want big public impact, well, they've invested in that. And actually, PBSRC, EPSRC have invested in that. And there are line items and referees' requests and so on. Explicitly, that gets you a bit of a push-up in these things. If the science is not going to work, then you're not going to get it funded. And it's highly competitive. So, okay, it's not always going to work. But these things are in there. So I would like to give due respect to the research councils for trying to be ahead here. And they have given a lead, and they've got a massive lead to pull on the universities because there's a big funding element in there. The business issue, yes, it's a significant problem, but there are mechanisms working in there, but most of them do tend to be working around the model that business will put something in and the UK government sector puts money in, or the university does as well, and you divvy it up and do something. But collaborative projects with industry, I think, are just showing how the community is returning to probably what was the pre-war model of before universities got as big in research as they are now, much broader breadth in the research community. And that extends to bringing in lots of people who may be doing part-time stuff, and that's where the joining up that the online communities allow of bringing in all the long, long tail of people who can add in some expertise can just get involved somehow. That is cheaper to fund. That is possible. Funding somebody to come and visit you and give a day's worth of consultancy is possible. And that sort of thing is tremendously valuable. This person who's been working in a completely different area comes in, you can pay for that, suddenly saved you several months' work because you were doing the wrong thing. And I think we have to recognise that small-scale thing, that they give you advice via this route and that you can get access to your data because you've made it easier and so on. That is a very valuable thing that I think will show up. How we actually really highlight that this was done in the final publications and the final reports, I think, something we have to address.
I think many universities do provide support. I think that's been touched on already through business engagement offices and support for sort of spin-out companies and the like. I mean, at Warwick, we have a limited company, Warwick Ventures, and there's an awful lot of money put into that. And obviously, getting the kind of golden gains is a very rare occurrence. But it's not just about, chasing, business deals, I think. I mean, one thing that we've done, for example, at Warwick, is we started up a thing called the Warwick Commission. And the Warwick Commission is not about chasing REF, it's not about chasing research outputs, and it's not about chasing venture capitalists and business opportunities. It was about scholarship and study in a specific theme. And it also did a good job of raising the profile of the institution. The first one we held was a commission on world trade. We've also held one subsequently on things like international finance. Now, those are obviously in the social sciences. And several hundreds of thousands of pounds are invested in those initiatives. So I think, you know, universities, and university structures can be developed to support these kind of activities.
Okay, so at this stage, I'd like to open it up to the floor if anyone's got any questions. And if you do have a question, just stick your hand up. This is my exercise for the week, is running around with the microphone. And just please state your name and where you're from for the live streaming.
Hi, Simon Crockell, University of Newcastle. Is "we understand the world a little bit more" a valid answer to the "what have you achieved in your 5-year project" question?
You'd need some very good evidence of why you think you understand the world better, but at a top level, yes. How do you understand it better? What's the evidence that you understand it better? Does anybody else understand it better? Might be questions we'd come back with.
Yep. On that same point, Daniel Meechan, Wikimedia and Open Knowledge Foundation. The wiki approach to doing this would be let's use the introductory part of the grant proposal, put it up in public, and then after the research project or while it proceeds, update that part. And then at the end, you can just select the two versions, the first and the last one, and send the link with the difference to the funder, and that's the impact that you've had. If all this happens in public, then any people who want to criticize what has happened in that project, they can voice their criticism, they can add to that page, and the whole process would be much more transparent, and people would start to
understand. It wasn't me.
And people might actually start to understand why certain projects are being funded and others not. And in relation to that, there is a general comment. One of the major impediment of doing science in the open and doing the whole cycle of science in the open is that you can't get the decisions by funders in public. No major funder does their decisions in public. So if they do something in public, it's just those grants that have been approved, but you never know who else was in the game, and you never know why the ones were chosen over the others. And having one funder or a group of funders stepping forward in this would be a big improvement for open science.
Okay, I understand where you're coming from. I'm not in a position to make that happen, I have to say, incidentally. I think, yes, it's the peer review process for deciding which applications get funded is kept private. And there are lots of arguments on either side as to why that's the case. And research councils have visited this from time to time. You don't find out the specifics of the proposals that went in. We all make our success rates public. You know which institutions are putting in numbers of applications, how much they're applying for and how much they're getting. You do have that information. That's public. You do know the criteria against which these things are judged. You know what the criteria used by the committees, the criteria used by the referees. That's all public. We do say which ones have been successful. I don't think it's a huge leap of imagination to say they're successful because they scored better against these criteria than the others. That's essentially at the heart of it. And it is the final decisions tend to be taken by peer review panels or committees based on the application, referees' comments, and any further comment that's come in response to the referees. There's a good debate to be had about how open that should be. The position we're in at the moment is that following referral to the Information Commissioner for public access to referees' comments, that has been deemed detrimental to running Research Council business properly. So that's where we are with it. That's my best. I don't work at the outset, I work at the evaluation end rather than the appraisal end, so I'm not expert on that side of it, but that's my understanding of where we are.
I just pick up on the other side, the output side, because I think there are real problems when you have only moderate success rates. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a lottery at some point, and it does depend on exactly what's happened. And you can always have a debate on it. Another group might have come up with a different decision, but so other, you know, different people advantage, disadvantage, and it changes. I think it's an interesting issue with doing how much you put out and when you put it out and how you put it out. So my normal position when you're dealing with an area that's not going to has maybe a lot of interest but not necessarily a lot of money associated with it, because there are whole issues when commercial exploitation comes in, and if it is industry funded and privately funded, well, then other considerations, is that on the whole, when you make the publication, all the necessary information that you could possibly provide should be provided. But there's a problem if you do that. And you just do that. I can easily provide you with all the experimental data, the gigabytes of stuff, and that's on the small science, not individual bits of large images, that go into a particular paper that's been published, and I can even perhaps tell you which bits I selected. Is that valuable to you? Probably to very, very few people who follow the argument through and pick it up. It actually turns out to be great if you're teaching in the area but not an expert in it, because it's very hard to get raw data to produce examples for teaching. If you're not, don't know somebody in the business. But if you're going to do this and make it worthwhile, a huge amount of effort has to go in to making that data, sorting it and screening it, selecting it, but putting it there, but showing how it's linked up, what bits are relevant, and so on. Now, some of our work is to try and automate that, so it's not a big effort. But in the end, putting stuff out for public consumption, wide range of people, needs a lot of work done on it. So it comes at a cost. And I think you have to actually start thinking about, is it worth that cost? So making it so that there's an audit trail, so if subsequently it's necessary, you can check it, that's one thing. But putting it out in a useful manner, I think you have to think very carefully. And I'm generally in favour of doing it. The question is how to do it in the most productive manner. And just dumping 100 gigabytes onto the web is not generally the most productive way. It provides an audit trail, satisfies certain data management plans that may be coming in, because these are going to be requirements. But how much extra effort should you put in, and what is the cost, and who's going to pay that cost, and both in the amount of time? Cameron is a very exhaustive blogger. It's very good. It's exhausting. I can't match that. I can't produce that level of output and do my normal job and anything else I want to do. There's a problem there. So how am I going to get my stuff out at that sort of level in that sort of very informative manner? And if I can't do that, is there value to just dumping a file on there? And I think that's where we've got a lot more thinking needs to be done.
And also how you evaluate different strategies in terms of doing that. What's the right approach to take?
Peter Murray Rust. I can see this problem from both sides. You know, I have been a traditional scientist doing research, publishing papers, but over the last year we've had a grant to the Open Knowledge Foundation through JISC and BIS to look at research outcomes. I want to talk to Murray afterwards about this, which we called OSID. We were tasked with the problem of looking at research grants and trying to come up with outcomes that could be made public. And it's actually very difficult to do indeed. You can come up with some papers. Most academics don't actually make it clear what grants were used to fund the papers. I think the US is better at this than the UK. That's one of the... I'm becoming, you know, a totalitarian. I would demand this, right? But even if you do that, what you're saying is this is what 0.1% of the population is interested in and even often can have access to. You've published a paper, right? Okay. Now, most of the time, that message just gets into the academic community. It doesn't get into the wider community. Some of the studies have looked at patents, and that is a valuable output because it relates to wealth creation and so on. Some of the work that we did with the NERC, National Environment Research Council, there's a much greater concentration on research outputs such as data sets, which can be publicly available and which one can build wealth generation products on top of, so that the outputs are primary and everybody can have them, and then people build things like, you know, tools for forecasting whether your birthday party is going to have rain or whatever it is. So I do think more research resource should be put into this. It can't be huge, but I think that it's an area which would definitely benefit having greater promotion.
I'm guessing no one's going to want to disagree with that.
Yes.
No. I think, I mean, there's another point, draw a point out here that that funders and institutions find it very difficult often to find those trails of outcomes from research and the impact that research has. So as researchers, people looking for funding, people involved in trying to make a claim about what you've done and what impact it's had, telling those stories and telling them to institutions and funders is actually a very powerful way of describing why your non-traditional outputs have value, and it's actually something that will be listened to at fairly high levels, I think.
It's one small point in response to what you were saying about attribution, essentially, and it's actually a fairly little known fact, I think, that the research councils do specify as part of our terms and conditions of grant that if you publish, you should acknowledge the grant. The difficulty is policing that, frankly. It's very difficult.
There are a lot of very interesting things about that, and mandating that, which is clearly sensible, and we do try and do it, one also needs to make it easy. It's the same thing about giving a citation for this image that you've got in your talk. And most people are more than happy to do this, right? It's just got to be made easy. So it's really nice when you go searching around, inevitably using some search engine. I'll be careful which one I name, given my funders are in the audience, or some of them. Whichever, and you come up with a journal, and you click on this picture, and you download it, and lo and behold, this PowerPoint slide opens with the citation in it, and everything's there. Great. Well, fine. Now, we know that can be done, and that you can actually copy and paste off the websites now, and the BBS is the same. It's made much easier for anybody to dump it in there. Now, those are small little things. They make a huge difference to whoever's image it was. It's got the citation in there in exactly the way they want it, which maybe their funders need and so on. And it's great, and it's maybe even got the XML behind it so that it can be found and searched for. Tiny, trivial things. But that's, if you take care and attention to that detail, then that actually just shows everybody else this is what it's all about, and that we really believe in this trail and so on. And just little things like that, other people see the use of, and then they'll buy into this the whole idea.
Thank you. My name is Christy Holmes, and I'm from Washington University in St. Louis, from the U.S. And so there's been a lot of discussion about, there's a lot of diverse information that we need to get out there. And if you think about the different people that might be consuming that information, there's different groups, they're from the layperson to the highly technical. We've had a really good example of some research studies where they've actually tried to be very proactive from the beginning of the funding period to present information aggregated on a website that cuts across a number of different types of project outputs. So looking at slides from presentations to noting changes in policy or billing codes, press releases, or discussing research projects. And I'm wondering if you could please talk a little bit about the role of funding bodies as well as of scientists in being proactive and deciding from the start to make that available in an easily consumable fashion online.
Let me just say that it's an ideal. And when I was fortunate in getting a large project some years ago, which is actually 6 years on coming to fruition, although the funding finished some time ago, and we had discussed at the beginning, we would try and work out how to employ a journalist to come round every few weeks and see what we'd done and talk to the students and the postdocs. It was a big project, so a lot there about their experiences and so on, and actually try and build up this. the funding was the problem then, because you actually have to pay somebody a reasonable amount to do that, and it's not going to pay off. In this case, it wouldn't have paid off for 6 years, perhaps, because there was no story to be told. There were cases where we've had on the TV programs about researchers doing things and actually their life day to day. And it's great when it comes to an end and there's actually a story. I think being proactive about it and getting things up there as much as you can, depending on your conditions, would be absolutely ideal. It's a huge commitment, and not just a financial commitment. It's a commitment on behalf of the research group. And in the end, it was both a finance and a time commitment. And the time scales that we were working on, which were very long in this case, that just meant the whole thing didn't pick up. But I would be very happy to try and do that in the future. And we do have our own internal publicity operations who are delighted to receive stuff from us. And I know that we don't always write these things in a way that's consumable. We can learn. I certainly would try and encourage my students to learn how to do that. Some of them will, some of them won't. But there's got to be the reward for it. And some of them, having their name in the newspaper, is enough reward. Others, that's not going to count for anything for their career forward. And then you may have to get professionals in. They exist. It's just a question of working out a risk-reward ratio in actually whether that will impact on the success of your project and the publicity of the project. But in general, though, getting people in who are skilled at doing that will give a much better presentation than us trying to hack up something together. But putting something up is better than nothing, mostly. But again, I come back to considering what it is that you put up and making sure that that's actually useful.
Just one comment, I think, and I don't know, as I'm going to talk a little bit about another aspect of funding in the UK, which is quite controversial at the moment, and that is that the element of the REF that is going to focus on impact and the way in which the institution submitting impact case studies are working to make that happen. And it sounds to me as though the sorts of packages the institutions may come up with are around this telling the story about how what has happened as a result of putting the research in. And one of the controversial aspects of it is that to do that well is expensive, and how do institutions do it in a way? The reward is, I assume, though I'm not speaking on behalf of the research councils, I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of the funding councils, but the expectation, I assume, is that the outcomes from the REF are going to influence the funding council's allocation of monies to the institutions after the REF has happened. So there is an element of how you do this being recognised. It's a very tricky one, because to do it well is resource intensive, and I do think as funders, how much do we want to be funding that aspect as opposed to doing the original research? And that's a really tricky decision to make.
The REF impact agenda is quite an interesting topic, isn't it? Why does it exist? It exists because the funding councils have attempted to protect the quality research funding base by demonstrating the value of research. That's the reason it exists. The problem we face with REF's impact agenda is presenting information and collating information, choosing the right information. So you've got to present an overarching statement on how you enable impact and case studies per roughly 10 FTE of staff submitted. The problem with that is that the research can extend back to around the early 90s, 93 I think it is, onwards. So this could be attached to people who've left your institution or even died, actually. So you've got a challenge where you haven't necessarily collected data for this exercise historically. And that's the problem I think we face with this rapidly changing environment.
Well, we're going to have to bring it to a close. I'm sorry, Ian. But if I could just ask you, we've talked a lot about impact in general. We've sort of focused on how you capture some of that, but if we come back to where we started, could I get each of the panelists just really quickly to what is a single concrete action that either individuals, communities, or collectively we can take that will actually provide the incentives for people to exploit the opportunities that online tools provide? We'll start with Nick.
Some kind of funding avenue. Basically, if I so something that came out yesterday in a meeting at the Royal Society, Michael Nielsen gave a talk about open source software and lessons for science. And someone, question from the audience, pointed out a contrast with open source software, which is that, as he put it, you need a lab to do science. And I said, no, that's not the case. Science needs labs, for sure, an experiment. But all I need is access. All I need to do science is access. I need access to data, to code, and to publications, which is critical because I can't afford a single journal, a single article from a pay journal, and to the community, which the community, generally speaking, does grant that access if they accept me. They accept me as a serious researcher. And most importantly, for the long term, to funding.
Mari?
Okay. I think probably in a practical sense, in terms of open access and the open agenda, one of the things the research councils need to be doing, and we are starting to, it's the recognition and reward dimension, and it's to do with how we go about collecting the outputs and outcomes we're interested in. And I didn't talk about that at great length, but there are many, many things we're looking for. And we are building in the ability to reference online activities. And we need to get that right, and we need to be talking to people in this room about how we get that right.
Yeah, I think effective international collaboration and communication, put simply.
So I echo in many ways everything that's been said there, and the way I would want to do it is that we make our publications, even when they're the traditional style, they provide the information necessary to reproduce as much of the science that can perhaps be reproduced without the lab, so everybody can play with it, that we actually make very detailed accounts of those tools that we used to deal with the collaboration or that make the data available and show and indicate in that in the experimental or technical sections so that people actually know what we did do and how we did it. That's a good publicity in itself. And I'm concerned also to make sure that this reaches the very youngest in the community. I have two young children, and I want them to ask the sort of questions that I would ask about how something works and know that they are empowered to get the answers and try it and check it out themselves. One of the reasons why we took a blog front end to some of our stuff was my perception that that would be very attractive to the incoming research students. It was. It doesn't have to be attractive to my colleagues. It's the research students who are going to do the job. It's the undergraduates. Where are we going to get them from? There's a real problem, and that's our biggest nightmare, I think, is getting at the youngest people and showing them that they can do this. And then the experiments can be very simple. And they can do that, and we can provide them with the more difficult, more controlled data can be available if they can get it from our staff to do a more difficult experiment. They are our biggest target audience that we must address and must make this interesting for them to do, and that they understand that this is a really important exercise in doing this research. And I don't think we're doing a very good job at the moment.
So on that note, if I pull out a couple of themes there, that in terms of what people in this room can do, we all want to see more credit, we all want to see that these things are viable for us to be doing. I think there's some things I pulled out there is tell the stories. Go out there and tell the people who want to listen about what you're doing and why it's important. Attribute and cite all of the tools, people, contributions that make your work possible and acknowledge the contributions and be generous in your acknowledgement, because it's acknowledgement and recognition of, as Mari said, how the research has changed the world. That are the things that are actually going to be the measures that you're going to be judged on as researchers or as commercial providers, publishers, technology offerings, and all of those things. So at that point, we are about 1.5 minutes over time, which is not too bad at the end of the day. And could I just ask you to thank the panel again, and thank you for your contribution.